Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley, being brought to you this evening at the Tech Museum of Innovation in downtown San Jose. I'm Chuck Geschke, Chairman of the Board of Adobe Systems Incorporated, and your chair for this evening's event. We also would like to welcome the viewers of C-SPAN and listeners to NPR Radio throughout the country, and we invite all of you who are in attendance here tonight or listening or watching us to visit the Commonwealth Club on the internet at www.commonwealth.org. And now to introduce this evening's speaker, Dr. John Warnock. John is the Chief Executive Officer and Co-Chairman of the Board with me of Adobe Systems, and most importantly for me personally, my longtime friend and colleague. I've worked with John for more than 20 years, and back in 1978, I felt very fortunate to attract him to join me at the somewhat fabled now Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. At PARC, we worked together on a variety of graphic software research projects and the design of an advanced printing protocol for Xerox Corporation. But like many before and after us in 1982, we forged off on our own. We left PARC, and we co-founded Adobe Systems, where we've had the good fortune to develop a host of pioneering software products, both in graphics and in electronic document technology, and together those products and our partnership with other companies launched what became known as the desktop publishing revolution. Today, Adobe generates over $1 billion in revenue, with nearly 60% of that revenue coming from customers who use Adobe's products primarily for preparing content and application of their ideas and strategies on the internet. Now, John himself has been a respected innovator in the computer software industry for over three decades. He holds several patents. He's received numerous awards for both technological innovation and business achievement. And in addition, as Peter mentioned earlier, he has been the chairman of the Tech Museum of Innovation for several years up until the opening of the museum a few years ago. John holds a PhD in electrical engineering from the University of Utah and has been very passionate about topics in the area of the graphic arts, design, the beauty of typography, and the elegance of old manuscripts. He's a collector of rare first editions of some of the most influential books and manuscripts produced over the last five centuries, some of which I'm sure he'll share with us tonight. But specifically, John is going to talk to us this evening about the very latest trends in publishing online and the positive ways that this technology can impact the publishing industry in the future. So now it's my pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, John Warnock.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here tonight and to share with you a perspective on the publishing industry over the last five centuries and where I think it's going to go, because we are in an area right now of very, very dramatic change. And that change is having an impact not only on the way we consume information, but on the way we communicate it and on how that information sort of permeates society and educates everyone. The success of Adobe, I think, is in large part due to the fact that we have, both Chuck and I, have a very deep respect for the past, for the graphic arts tradition that has actually taken place over the last 500 years. There really have been a lot of innovators over the years, and they have brought a lot of passion to communicating information effectively. If you lose sight of that and you only pay attention to the computer, then you lose a lot of the history and a lot of the beauty that is in the publishing, in our publishing past. Books have been around for a long, long time. But they were sort of for a very, very small select group of people. They were only for the people in the clergy or the people who were very, very rich who could afford them. Because before about 1450, the process of producing a book was hiring a scribe to reproduce the book line by line, letter by letter, writing typically on vellum with black ink, and building a book that then became a treasured part of the person's property. So the book was not a communicator of information. It was really a repository of very, very important stuff that was very, very expensive. So the whole process started out, and the origin of this is in somewhat dispute, but most people generally give the credit to Johannes Gutenberg in 1450 when he attempted to build the Latin Bible, the famous 42-line Bible. He perfected the process of building movable type, movable metal type, that would hold up after impression when run off the press. There were about 200 Bibles printed off the initial Gutenberg press, and they learned a lot in the process. About 100 of those were done on vellum, and the rest were done on paper. The invention of printing not only spurred more inventions about printing, but it also spurred the actual use of paper. Even though paper goes back centuries and centuries and centuries, paper was not in widespread use for any particular purpose, because if you had one of these incredibly valuable books, you would use vellum, and you would put the book on the vellum. But with the mass production of books, with the invention of the printing press, it was impractical to kill the number of animals that had to be killed to produce books in any quantity. Had the entire press run of Gutenberg's Bible been done on vellum, it would have taken 6,000 head of cattle to produce the paper or the vellum sheets that would have been necessary to print the Bible, and that was a little prohibitive even then. So paper technology started to take place. Now, paper in those days was built out of primarily linen. So it was rag-based paper where they would beat the rags to a pulp and then use the sieves to produce the paper. And all of the books up until about the 19th century were printed on rag-based papers. Consequently, if you have a book that's older than the 1800s, there is no problem with it getting old. It's like it was brand new, because the paper doesn't turn brown, it doesn't rot, it doesn't decay, it just hangs in there. So tonight I'd like to show you that this is actually true. Okay. So this is a page out of a Gutenberg Bible. Okay, this is a real page. This was printed in about 1450. And you'll notice in this Bible that the quality of the text and the spacing between the words is incredibly uniform. You can't pick up a modern publication today and see this kind of text. And the reason that you can't see this kind of text today is because Gutenberg went to extraordinary measures to make it so that the spacing looked as good as the best scribe could put down. And so what he had to do is he had to make multiple versions of every letter E in different widths, and multiple versions of A in different widths. So he had a total repository of 192 glyphs that he then laid out the text pages. And so the uniformity of the page is due to that incredible uniformity that he got by adjusting the width of each character and getting that in. And you won't see this in any publication since Gutenberg. Now, the interesting thing about this is all the Bibles these days are in institutions. So they're in the Library of Congress. The New York Public Library has three. The Gutenberg Library in Mainz has three. So they're spread. The British Library has a couple. So they're spread in the libraries of the world. There aren't any existing Gutenberg libraries in private hands. The last one that went on the auction block was in 1982. And it went for $5 million. I suspect if a Gutenberg Bible went on the auction block today that it would go in excess of $40 or $50 million. So this is a rare document, but it really started the whole process of using printing as a communication media. It really started the whole process of the Enlightenment. And really, the invention of the printing press and of movable type, not of the printing press, but of movable type, really was a pivotal event in Western history. Now, a very fortunate thing happened. In 1455, Mainz was overrun and sacked by invaders. And what that did is that forced the printers out into Europe. So there was a printing population that existed primarily in Mainz. And in 1455, they overran the town, and everybody fled, and the printers fled, and they spread out throughout Europe. And so printing spread very, very rapidly throughout Europe in the 1455 to 1460 time frame and started to grow throughout Europe. And pretty much printing took the same model that it did with Gutenberg. You printed these things for, they were still very expensive books. They were still owned by relatively few people. And that those relatively few people were the scholars and the clergy or the church who could maintain them. Now, what did a book look like in that time period? This is what a book looked like. So this is a book that was printed in Basel, Switzerland in 1468. Okay? Now, the remarkable thing about this book is it's not fragile. It has solid wooden boards. It has brass nodules here. It has a clasp with which to lock it. And it has the chain to which you chained it to the library stand. So this is the original binding of a book printed in 1458 or 68. If you open the book, okay, you will see that they still took enormous care in the way that it was typed, and you can feel the texture of the type as it was impressed into the page. Now, this book is a remarkable book because this was the first printing of Summa Theologica by St. Thomas Aquinas. And it's a remarkable amount of work. If you think of the amount of type that it took to put this book down, to print it, and then to bind it and put it together, and to build a binding like this, I mean, it's a remarkable thing. Now, you don't put this in your pocket or take it to bed at night and read it. So, but you do chain it to the library, and that's the way they worked with books. Now, the remarkable invention happened by an Italian printer named Aldus Manutius. He also invented italic type. So when you see italic type, that's Aldus Manutius. That was his contribution. He made a bigger contribution, though. He was the first person to print small books. So this is actually a book printed by Aldus Manutius. It's a handbook on grammar. And it happens to be a copy that was owned by Leibniz. So this book was printed in 1508, somewhere around, 1516. Anyway, by the Aldine Press, which was Aldus Manutius Press. And the nifty thing about this is that now books were portable. So they not only printed books, but they were much less expensive to print. They started to get the paper technologies in place, and now information started to move throughout Europe. And this was really the first time that information started to become accessible to sort of the common man. Because books went down in price, they got larger print runs, and they got started to distribute throughout Europe. And so so literacy started to happen. There was still a problem in that the great books, new ideas now started to propagate, and documents traveled between England and traveled between France and Germany and Italy, and Newton would read Galileo, and they would both read Copernicus and things like that. So the information, scientific information, started to flow. Now, one of the pivotal books that really changed the direction of science forever was this book. Okay, this book was printed in 1543, and unfortunately, the author never lived to see this book printed, but that was by design. He couldn't have this book printed in his lifetime, because if he did print this book in his lifetime, he would have been persecuted by the church. So this is De Revolutionibus, I think is the right pronunciation, but it's by Nicholas Copernicus. And this is the first time that it was postulated that the planets revolve around the sun. And he knew that if this was printed during his lifetime, that he would be prosecuted by the church. So sort of the day after he died, his friends published his work. If you read the translations of the Copernicus work, you find that the guy was an extraordinary genius. He had insights in how to prove his thesis in a way that left no air holes. I mean, he really nailed it when he postulated that the planets revolved around the Earth. He not only nailed it with the mathematical calculations, but with the reasoning and with all of the other tables and observations that he had taken out throughout his life. Now, great things started to happen with the book now becoming a popular mechanism. You had Galileo come along. He also had a problem with the church. But he continued to publish. Galileo published probably 10 different books. He continued to try to observe the world around us. As you read these books in their original form, they're not the way you get them in school. Because schools have a tendency to rehash the information and repostulate it in a way that's more convenient to understand, not the way they actually invented it. So one of the joys of going through these things is actually figuring out the discovery process that Galileo went through. What was the reasoning that he went through to discover what he discovered? And you'll find it's different than the physics books. If you read Newton, it's the same thing. You'll read how Newton sort of figured out how the Earth and gravity works and how the planets revolve around the sun. If you read Harvey on the circulation of blood, you figure out how he figured out how blood circulates throughout the body. If you read Benjamin Franklin on electricity, he was not only figuring out how electrostatic electricity works, but he was also making up all the terms, that most of which survive today, about the phenomena that he was observing. So these books are not only great artifacts and great sort of testaments to the past, but they're sort of a window on the world of what the discovery process is all about and what they were thinking of when these things happened. So reading them is also like sort of taking a time travel through history, being in the place where they were, seeing the sights that they saw, and sort of knowing history in the context of their ideas. Some things have gotten worse over the years. I should have brought it. It's too big. I have a copy of Samuel Johnson's dictionary. Samuel Johnson was one of the most extraordinary men. He had an incredible mind. He had a photographic memory. And he single-handedly wrote the first English language dictionary. It took him 7 years to do this. But the guy had an incredible photographic memory, and he would keep slips of paper as he would go through words, and he had a bunch of clerks assembling this stuff. To give you an idea of the magnitude of the job, the French were producing a French dictionary about the same time, and it took 40 of them to build, 40 scholars in France, to build the same thing that Johnson did in England. And Johnson's comment on that was, well, one Englishman, 40 Frenchmen, it's fair. So if you read Johnson's dictionary, you'll find that we have lost something in building dictionaries over the years. What Johnson did is he would put down the word, and then he would go back into literature and pick out his favorite quotes to demonstrate what the word meant. And so he very frequently would quote Shakespeare. He very frequently would quote, he had this encyclopedic memory where he would just pull these quotes out that would demonstrate the meaning of the word. And if you read current day dictionaries, they're somewhat sterile in relationship to Johnson's dictionary. So if you ever have an opportunity to look at Johnson's dictionary, I think it would be great. Another interesting book along the way that I acquired was the first edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. This is truly funny because it's in three volumes. The first volume is about this thick, and it covers A and B. And then the rest is in the other two volumes. And clearly they started this thing out and they said, whoa, this is much harder than I ever would imagine. And so they abbreviated the second volumes. But it's cool. Publishing as an art form has really improved over the years. The technologies have gotten better. Sometimes we look back and there's been some backsliding, like type has gotten sometimes worse, sometimes better over the years. There were sort of bad books that were printed because printing was becoming cheap. There were those people who sort of put out the cheap novels. They weren't novels, but they put out cheap books, and with atrocious typography, bad paper, bad printing. And so all throughout history, you see a lot of that. You do see the technology start to improve, though. In the 18th century, you see lithography come along. You see color printing start to get in the late the latter part of the 19th century. And you see these increments in technology. Now, typesetting was always hard. They had to take these little slugs of type and put them into the line, build up a page, then print the page. And that became a very laborious process. In the late 1800s, two companies, one called Linotype and one called Monotype, invented automatic typecasting machines in which they would hit the letters and automatically pour those into lead molds. The lead molds would produce strips of lead that then could be racked up and put into printing presses. And that advance in printing actually sort of caused the daily newspaper, because the daily newspaper was not a practical endeavor before the advent of the Monotypes and Linotype machines. So technology goes forward. Now publishing is becoming high-volume stuff. They found that cloth-based papers were not economic, so in the 19th century they invented wood-based papers, which was probably one of the worst things that they did, because if you have a wood-based paper, it has acid in it, and the acid eats the paper as it goes, so old books from the 1800s are brown and are falling apart. So if you take up first edition of Darwin's Origin of the Species, the paper is not in great shape. If you have a first edition of the Federalist Papers, it's absolutely brown. Okay, and those are the books that the Library of Congress and all the great libraries are worried about, because those are the ones that are disintegrating. These things will never disintegrate. I mean, these things will last another 500 years with no problems whatsoever. So paper technologies got better, printing got cheaper, broader based, in some senses worse. And pretty much printing technologies stayed the same until the 60s, when type and hot lead type went away altogether and they replaced photography. So they had photo typesetters in the 60s, and they started the process of hooking those up to computers. And a lot of publishing was made possible by hooking these photo typesetters up to computers and driving those from computers in the 60s. Then the big change came, and my buddy and I got to participate in the big change. The personal computer came along in the early 1980s. The personal computer now made low-cost computing accessible. Number one, technological advance. Number two technological advance was the graphical user interface. Now you had these bitmap displays where on the screen you could actually see text and you could actually see type. And the Apple Macintosh was the first graphical user interface, and that was introduced introduced with the Lisa, but the Macintosh was actually the first commercially viable one. Now, at Xerox PARC, we had bitmap displays, and we had laser printers, and we had all of this stuff at Xerox PARC in the 70s, during the mid-70s. So this was not new stuff, but Steve Jobs saw fit to commercialize it as opposed to Xerox, and so he brought out the first graphical user interface. We had been working on printing technologies at all of our time at PARC, and we knew how to drive laser printers. And so we built a language called PostScript that actually would deal with type. and actually deal with high-quality graphics and actually deal with the qualities that the graphic arts actually required. All of the other sort of tools for printing that computer people had come up with did not pay proper respect to what is important in typography, what is important in communication, and what is important in printing. We paid attention to those details with PostScript, and so this confluence of things happened. The other technological advance was the invention of the low-cost laser printer by Canon. So in the 1985 time frame, Canon came out with the first low-cost laser printer. Paul Brainerd started Aldus Corporation in Seattle and came out with the first personal computer page makeup software called PageMaker. All of these things happened somewhat independently, but all at the same time. And they came together to sort of start desktop publishing. And that was the beginning of the end of doing it the old way. You see very, very few traditional presses. Traditional presses are kept around for art books and for very low-run books of a very special nature. And I hope that they stay around forever because they're sort of a testament to the history of publishing. But you probably have noticed in your mailbox that you get a lot more catalogs than you did 20 years ago. 20 years ago, there was only one catalog. That was the Sears Roebuck catalog. Now that's been replaced by thousands of catalogs that you get deluged with every day. Well, we're responsible for this. You also probably notice that there are a bazillion magazines on the newsstands these days. Before, it used to be easy. You had Post and Life and, you know, Look and book magazines like that. Now you see Cigar Aficionado, you know, Raising Thoroughbred, Palominos, I mean, whatever. And you have all these specialty magazines. And the reason is that the cost of publishing has plummeted and that the cost isn't in this pre-press process, it's really in the authoring process and still the fundamental printing process. So there has been an explosion of printing over the last 20 years. There has been an explosion of technology around printing and the democratization of it. So now, with not much money, you can actually start your own magazine. And, I mean, Martha Stewart did it. And actually make a go of it. Because the economics have fundamentally changed. Well, that was one big change. Now the change that's happening is that the internet is the ultimate democratizer of information. It is giving access to everybody sort of at the speed of light of all the information they could possibly want to consume. Publishing is changing. I'm old enough, and my buddy's certainly old enough. he's older than I am. Not much. To remember the first televisions. And I remember the first television programs were glorified radio programs. People would get up in front of the camera and pretend like they were on radio. Television has changed dramatically over the last 50 years. The way you produce a television program, the content, the amount of media that they sort of shove at you in a television program is very, very different than a television program out of the 50s. Did television kill radio? No. Radio is alive and well. Radio still has its place in the communication sphere. Will the internet kill print? Not at all. Never going to happen. But it will relegate print to a different role. The roles will change. Will the internet kill television? No, but it will relegate it to a different role. For information communication and high bandwidth communication, the internet now is the new publishing media. And it isn't rehashing like television. It's not rehashing radio. It's not taking a newspaper and transliterating it to the internet. It's not taking a magazine and making the magazine articles and the ads look like they do in the magazine on the internet. It's not like taking a TV program and playing a TV channel. Remember all the talk about the 500 TV channels that were going to come over the internet? Well, there aren't going to be 500 TV channels. There are going to be 50,000 TV channels, and they're not going to be channels. They're going to be something completely different. It is a new media with a new authoring component where all the media, photography, video, sound, text, graphs, charts, animation, all come together to communicate ideas more effectively than you can with any of the other media. Does it mean any of the other media is going to go away? Not at all. But we are now communicating at an economic rate that is fundamentally different than the economics of printing information and shipping it around. Within our own company, we essentially run pretty paperless. We pretty much run the company via 250,000 email messages a day, a quarter of which carry around electronic documents. We don't FedEx documents around. We don't have interoffice mail. We don't fill out forms. It's all electronic, and it's made the company more efficient. And the increase that you're seeing in economic productivity in the United States right now, quite frankly, is due to the Internet. And it's due to the Internet being used as a vehicle to make business processes fundamentally more productive. And the boom in our economy is not a mystical boom. It really is a flat-out productivity boom where the first personal computer for the first time is allowing our economy to grow and be productive to the levels that it's capable of being. So publishing in the future is going to be wild because every year we take a new sort of dipstick on what is happening, and it's changing extremely rapidly. And what is possible with communication is changing from day to day. The printers who have been in the business for 500 years and have operated under one business model are having their business models changed on them because of the Internet. Books, e-books are going to be there. The old process of printing a zillion books and carrying inventories of books and distributing them through bookstores, as you all know if you've been to Amazon, is going away. The world is changing very rapidly. But hopefully we'll still produce extraordinarily beautiful stuff that we will look back in the future and say, gee, let's not forget our history. Thank you.
Well, thank you, John. Not only interesting, but thought-provoking, and I'm sure is going to stimulate some interesting questions. And in fact, I'm now going to introduce Paul Saffo, who is the director of the Institute for the Future, who's going to handle the question and answer part of the program this evening. Paul is a technology forecaster who studies long-term information technology trends and their impact on business, society, and on our culture. His essays appear in a wide range of publications, from very highly specialized periodicals to well-known and broader distributed publications, including Harvard Business Review, Wired Magazine, the Los Angeles Times, and Fortune magazine. Paul holds degrees from Harvard, Cambridge, and Stanford. You must have been in school a long time, Paul. And recently, the World Economic Forum named Paul to the list of the 100 global leaders for tomorrow. Paul Saffo.
Thank you, Chuck. I hold in my hand a set of questions. I note that these are all on paper. Nothing was sent in to me via email. I checked my Palm Pilot during the whole time, but it's all on paper. So paper does have a future, at least for the rest of this evening. And actually, Chuck, John, why don't you come up and join me here? We have to share the microphone a little bit. And the first question for you, and I apologize to our friends out in Radio Land. The question was really to both John and Chuck, and that was, is a beard required to work at Adobe?
It is if you're old as we are. Now, there are actually people who don't have beards, right?
Yes, they're called women. I want to start with a couple of questions about your extraordinary collection of books. And when did you begin this collection, and describe a little bit of the parameters of it? And what was the first book you collected?
First of all, book collecting is a bona fide disease. This is something you catch, and once you have it, I'm afraid it's with you for life. My wife and family and I were in London in about 1987 at the Grosvenor House Antique Fair, and we were wandering through the stalls and looking at the paintings and the marvelous antiques that they have there, and we came across a bookstore called Maggs Bookstore. And if you've ever been to Maggs on Berkeley Square in London, this is an amazing bookstore because they have no idea what books they have, but they have millions of the things. And it's gone down through centuries of Maggs owners. But they had a book on the shelf, and my son came up to me and he said, "Dad, look at this book." And I went over, and it was Euclid's Elements. And since I got my undergraduate degrees in mathematics, I said, "Oh, Euclid's Elements." And I opened it up, and it was the first English printing that was printed in 1570. I said, "Oh, damn. What a neat book." And I opened it up, and not only did it have these wonderful geometric figures in it, it had little pop-ups to demonstrate some of the geometry. So you could fold these things out and pop them up. And it was a big fat book like this one. And I looked at the price, and Adobe had just gone public, so... So I said, "Well," and Marva said, "Oh, go ahead, buy it." So I bought this book. I got a deal on it now that I look back on it. So I brought it home, and now you can imagine. You walk into your library, and you put this book printed in 1570 up on the bookshelf. And it's the only one of its kind up on the bookshelf. And you say, "Gee, the book needs friends." I mean, there's a paperback next to it, and, you know, it wasn't right. So it needed friends, and so that started this long process of learning about them, sort of making some mistakes along the way. But then you decide, well, you just can't go willy-nilly off and collect all kinds of books. So being basically a scientist at heart, I said, "Gee, one of the neat things," there were two subjects I studied in college. One was mathematics and philosophy. The other one was philosophy. And as I started to find out, and I'd never known this before, that these books actually are sold and traded and moved in auction houses, and I'd never known this before, but I started to get educated, that you could really buy a first edition of Newton. You can really buy a first edition of Galileo. That these books do, in fact, traffic on the market. They're very rare. They're expensive. But they are somewhat available. And what happens is collectors will collect the books, and then they'll make a decision at the end of their life whether they give it to a library or whether they put it back in the open market. Now, this is one of the toughest decisions a book collector has to make, because if he gives it to a library, no one will ever see the books again. They'll get locked up in vaults, and no one will ever see them again. If you put them back on the auction block, at least the collector of the books will be able to see them again, and he may share them with his friends. So I have been dealing with dealers all over the world for the last 15 or so years, and have built up a collection of the books that I think have sort of changed the direction of mankind. So Newton, Galileo, Copernicus, Kepler, Harvey, Machiavelli, Hume, Berkeley, Immanuel Kant, Descartes, the Johnson Dictionary, some Shakespeare, Benjamin Franklin, some Jefferson, Madison, let's see, what else? I have the first printing of the Bill of Rights. And so these are documents that have really changed mankind. And they're remarkable because they, as I say, they're a time capsule back into history. So that's how I got in, and it is a disease.
John, would you actually just say a little bit about how you came into possession of that printing of the copy of the Bill of Rights? I think it's an extraordinary tale of how these things turn up.
Well, a dealer that I know who actually lives in Baltimore called me one day, and he said, "John," he said, "a person sold me a document," and he said, "I believe that this is the first broadsheet printing of the Bill of Rights." He said, the person who sold it to me found it in the back of a frame, a picture frame. And as I unfolded it, I sort of realized what it is. I bought it from the individual. And then he spent about 3 months researching the history, making sure that the document was legitimate. Well, it turns out that there are only 7 surviving copies. And they're all in institutions except mine. There aren't many of theirs. They were printed in Maryland. What actually happened is Congress released the Bill of Rights to the states for ratification. And they prepared by hand written versions for each state to sort of keep and protect. But in order for people to actually read what the Bill of Rights said, they have to have it printed. And so they sent it to a printer in Maryland who printed something like 200 broadsheets, and he then distributed those to the states. And then the state legislatures went over these broadsheets and ratified them. Now, there were 12 rights in the original thing that Congress distributed in 1789 to the states. The first two amendments to the Constitution had to do with the pain of Congress, and the states had the infinite wisdom not to ratify those. So the first amendment, then, is the Freedom of Speech Amendment, which is actually the third one listed on the Bill of Rights.
I just want to note that if you sensed or misapprehended a little bit of antipathy in John's comments about libraries and giving over precious books to libraries, he's really not that way. In fact, the Warnocks are not just involved in publishing today. This is really becoming something of a publishing dynasty. John would be too modest to mention it, but his son is deep in this as well. And just as John has dived into publishing, his son is, I think, in the process of reinventing libraries for a digital age. And I fully expect to see his son here in 10 years or so talking about his extraordinary accomplishments as well. But back to some practical questions. John, you talked about your collection and the focus of it, and I'm just going to read this question straight across, so no editorial comment. The books in your collection, do you usually read them or just primarily collect them? And for those that you do read, do you generally read them right after you acquire them or a long time after?
A long time after. Well, first of all, a lot of them are in Latin, and I don't read Latin. A lot of them are in German, and I don't read German. But what I typically try to do is get an English translation of the book and read the English translation. If the English translation was done, a lot of times I'll try to get actually the English translation that was done as close to the original time as possible. So in the case of Newton's Principia, Newton's first edition of Principia was never translated into English. And to this day has never been translated into English. It was the third edition that was translated first into English, and I bought a copy of that and read that. The first Galileo translation was done by an Englishman, and that's actually the copy that Newton read, because Galileo wrote a very funny kind of Latin. It was half Italian and half Latin, and it was easier to read it in English. But you try to read these. Benjamin Franklin's great. It's in English. Shakespeare's great. It's in English. Malthus is great. Hume is great. Kant is in German. Sorry. So that's the way that works.
Now, of course, I mean, these are not just curiosities. They're actual valuable research objects. I know there's a story behind your edition of Copernicus and Owen Gingrich, who was tracking down those available editions. Can you say just a little bit about that?
There is this guy at Harvard whose his name is Owen Gingrich, and he is a professor of history, of science history. So he's a professor of science history. And his quest in life has been to see and make annotations about every copy of Copernicus that exists out there. So there are about 240 of these things, and Owen has traveled the world to see every copy. And I think there's some that he knows about that he hasn't seen. But I remember after I acquired this copy, the book dealing world is weird. If you buy a book through auction, you can't find out who bought the book. Okay, the auction house simply won't tell you. If you buy a book from a dealer and then ask the dealer, who did you sell the book to, they won't tell you. So they keep a very heavy cloak of secrecy over the exchange of these books. So I got a call from the book dealer who sold me the Copernicus, and he said he had been contacted by Owen Gingrich from Harvard, and would it be possible for me to contact Owen Gingrich to see if he could arrange then to come out and look at the book? So we got all that, and Owen came out, and he spent an hour and a half going through and making annotations about the book. That's the largest one he's ever seen. It's got the widest margins. He also said it's particularly uninteresting because it doesn't have any margin notes in it. So, but it does have the original endpaper painting on it. So the original owner printed his name across this blue endpaper painting. And most of the books, as they get rebound over the years, they trim them. They cut them down and rebind them and trim them. And getting an untrimmed copy of Copernicus, the only one he's ever seen, is nice.
Actually, you said it wasn't annotated, but I was just looking at it a moment ago, and I think that Owen signed it. Now, technology 4 centuries ago, or 5 centuries ago, led to this explosion in new book forms and the reinvention of the medium. And you've all been on the front rank of a similar kind of reinvention today. As the internet takes off and as the technologies continue to advance, what are we going to see in terms of surprises, in terms of new book forms? And one of the audience asked a very specific question about this, and that is, can we look forward to software tools specifically designed to make pop-up and movable books possible? And if you can take us a little farther beyond this, what are the really weird things we're going to see at the intersection of electronics and paper?
Well, I think what the internet obviously has already shown us is there's a whole new way to navigate information. With my son Christopher's project, what he's trying to do is make the traditional libraries much more approachable from a searching text point of view and navigating vast, vast quantities of information. I think any of you who have been up on the net and used Yahoo or AltaVista or the search engines know that you can do massive, massive searches across tons and tons and tons of information in a matter of seconds. And the book format never has lended itself to that. You have indexes, you have to look up pages, you have to cite references. So the whole navigation process of going through information, I think, will change dramatically. Also, there's no reason not to intermix video and sound and all of the different media types and animation types to prove a point. It's very difficult to put a pop-up in a book. It's very labor-intensive, and it's hard. It's not hard to put a movie in an electronic book, or it's not hard to build an animation to go into an electronic book, or to put sound in it, or to put a clarifying thing. So the learning process can be aided by using all of our senses. And I think that you will see these things that are not these wonderful printed books, but they are sort of media expressions that will exist in the ether, in the virtual space, that will be truly much more effective at communicating information. I forgot to show you one book. I've got to show you this one book. This book was, I won't say it was printed because it wasn't printed. It was constructed in 1859, okay? And it has this distinction of being sort of the first all-digital book. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that it wasn't printed. Okay, so how do you build a digital book in 1859? Well, it turns out that every one of the pages, okay, and it is an extraordinarily beautiful book, but every one of the pages was fed into the punched cards on a Jacquard loom, and the book was woven. Okay, at 240 silk threads to the inch. Okay, there are roughly 50 pages in this book, and if you think about the billions of dots that they had to construct by hand, program, put into the punch cards of a Jacquard loom, and weaved, It is totally extraordinary. Now, they didn't make a lot of these. And the only reason that they did it was to demonstrate the flexibility of the Jacquard loom. But this was a Herculean effort to construct this thing. And I can't imagine the amount of labor that went into this production. Not many of these survived. The problem wasn't in actually weaving the silk. It was actually gluing the silk to the boards that became the technological problem. And so they ruined most of them when they assembled them.
Gosh, technologically sweet, hopelessly complex, and almost completely pointless. Sounds like a startup in Silicon Valley. I have a supply-side question and a demand-side question. So I'm going to give you the supply-side question first. As an author, I'm interested in how online book publishing works for the author and publisher and reader, both practically and from the, and this is Silicon Valley, from the financial perspective.
Well, first of all, the desktop publishing revolution made it practical to self-publish books. Many, many more books are self-published now than were in the past because you now don't have to have the massive presses and the massive typesetting equipment that a publisher had or all the capital equipment to publish a book. You have a computer and your laser printer and you're in business. The internet, it even gets more extreme. Stephen King just put out a little novella on the internet, and they buried Amazon with the demand. There were about 400,000 downloads in the first day. The economics of that is that Stephen King really didn't need Simon & Schuster to do that. He could have gone directly to Amazon and cut a deal, or he could have gone to Yahoo and cut a deal. So the internet and electronic books, you're not worried about inventories anymore, you're not worrying about print runs, you're not worried about upfronting money, you're worried about content and the consumer. And so there's very little between you and the consumer. So the whole, and this is not just true of books, this is true of all the distribution mechanisms that are in place today, distribution models are changing very dramatically. And for printed publications, the relationship between the author and the reader is becoming closer and closer. So here's what's happening. The retail stores, like Amazon, are trying to disintermediate the publisher and work directly with the author. The publishers will try to disintermediate the stores and work directly with the consumer. So everybody is trying to disintermediate everybody else, and it will remain to be seen who wins.
We're coming down towards the end here, but let me give you my demand side question. Do you think it is worthwhile collecting modern first editions today? And again, this is Silicon Valley, so the follow-up is, will they increase in value? This is someone who's decided that collecting stock is not a good idea after last week.
Yeah, stock is not a collectible anymore. It's really interesting. Certain book dealers deal exclusively with 20th century first editions, and it's a somewhat speculative market because you're trying to make a decision of whether the author will have lasting value. Now, will Daniel Steele have lasting value? Who knows? Will Stephen King have lasting value? That is a judgment call that's speculative. F. Scott Fitzgerald has lasting value because the price of his books are starting to climb. And it looks that once you've sort of passed this threshold, they don't go down again. Steinbeck and Stegner are collectible. But no matter where you go in the printing world and in the authoring world, people will be collectors. They will collect first editions. They will go to the problems. And if they hit it and the author goes into favor, the book value will go up. In general, I can say that the value of books, unless if the book ends up having any significance, they start to go up and then they don't go down. So there's a book dealer I deal with called the 19th Century Shop, and he doesn't deal with 20th century stuff primarily because he's not willing to make the call.
Great. Well, I think we're down to our last question. And I'm going to give you a choice, John. I'm going to ask you two questions, and you can choose between them. Question one, will the new publishing lead us to a new enlightenment? And if so, what do you think it will look like? Question two is, why did you choose the name Adobe for your company?
I'm going to answer the first one. Well, I can answer both of them, actually. We're already going through the new enlightenment. That's in process. The decoding of the human genome is benefiting enormously by the existence of the internet and the communication mechanisms. Scientific journals and the exchange of information are benefiting enormously by the increased human information. Every consumer now who used to blindly take drugs from their doctor, whatever their doctor prescribed, now goes up on the internet and figures it out. What am I taking and what's it for? So the wholesale democratization of information is in process. And we are going through a new enlightenment. And if you haven't tried this new enlightenment, it's great. Second question, how did we name Adobe? Behind our houses is a creek called Adobe Creek. You go to the Secretary of State, say, how do I get a name of a company? You try a name, it's taken. It's like getting vanity license plates. We picked Adobe Systems.
Thank you so much, John, for sharing your insights and reminding us that the revolution we live in the midst of today is but the latest chapter in wave upon wave of revolutions sweeping over our culture. Now I'd like to invite Chuck Geschke back to the podium to take us out for the evening. Chuck?
Okay, well, thank you, John and Paul, both. Very fascinating presentation. And I also want to thank the audience here at the Tech Museum for joining us this evening, as well as our viewers out on C-SPAN and those listening on NPR. Now it's come to that time when I say that the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley, which is the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, has adjourned.